Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RZVS recognized specialist in small animal surgery orthopaedics, Kinley Smith. Thank you, Kinley. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello everybody, and thank you very much for listening to this presentation, and I hope first of all to try and keep you entertained, because I think we sometimes concentrate maybe a bit too much on the complicated and the difficult and the challenging, and sometimes we just need to sit back and just enjoy ourselves a little bit. So the first thing I want you to do, anyone who's trying to take notes, put your pencil down. Because what I want you to do is actually relax. This is not a webinar to get stressed about. This is one just to sit back and enjoy. So, let's start straight away with an interesting case. So, medial patellar luxation, we all see it very, very commonly. An 8-year-old Cocker Spaniel has chronic left hand lameness. It's got pain in its hip and pain in its stifle. It's had medial patellar luxation diagnosed, it's had hip dysplasia diagnosed, and assuming the pain was associated with the medial patellar luxation, it's had a tibial tuberosity transposition being performed. Problem is that the lameness didn't resolve and the luxation, although it's improved, persisted. So we get to see the case to see if there's anything else we can do for it. So here we have the radiographs. The tibial tuberosity has been transposed, it's been stabilized adequately, there's no evidence of any implant loosening. Everything looks quite nice. So we looked at this case and felt, well, yes, there's still a low-grade persistent medial patellar luxation, but we think now there's still significant discomfort in that hip. So we proceeded and did a fairly standard hip luxation. So we tend to do hybrid type procedures here, although this is a totally cemented stem and cup. And the reason we did this first before looking back at the stifle is often dogs will change the way they walk after you've done a hip replacement. So if the hip's uncomfortable, dogs can internally or externally rotate the stifle, which can change the way the stifle works. But also you can get them walking with circumduction, varus, valgus, so that this makes it quite difficult to predict what will happen. So do the hip replacement first. So we did the hip replacement and there was an improvement, but the medial patellar luxation persisted and did seem to cause some discomfort. The dog, having had a tibial tuberosity transposition and a sulcoplasty, we didn't want to repeat the sulcoplasty, so instead we revised the tibial tuberosity transposition and we placed a ridge stop prosthesis. A ridge stop is an abutment to the medial trochlear ridge of the sulcus, and what that does is tries to provide additional stability in medial patellar luxation. Unfortunately, this dog came back after a few months and was still pretty uncomfortable. So we went back to the theatre to see if there's anything else we could do for this patient. And when we looked in at surgery, you can see the ridge stop prosthesis just sitting to the side here, but in the area just to the lateral aspect of that, so still in the medial trochlear ridge, we've got this area of fairly profound chondromalacia. So for whatever reason, the patella is still not tracking properly. Now we have an issue here that we've done the tibial tuberosity transposition, or it's been done twice. We have a very, very poorly formed sulcus. So instead, we now have this fantastic option to replace the patella groove in its entirety. And the way we do this is we actually remove the entire patellar sulcus, place a base plate, and it's great because we can adjust the position, proximal, distal, medial, or lateral, and that allows us to place the patellar groove in a position that we wish. So when we look afterwards, now we get very, very, very good tracking of the patella afterwards. So the take home from this is multifactorial lameness can be quite challenging to do. So what happens if things in the stifle are really, really bad? So here we have an 8-year-old German Shepherd dog. It's 2-year history of left-hand lameness, and it's got quite profound stifle pain. So we cultured, we looked at this joint and cultured from the synovial fluid some Pseudomonas. This is pretty bad. You can see the secondary change in the stifle, profound osteophytosis throughout the stifle in all these areas. We have lots and lots of osteophytosis at the trochlear ridge, osteophytosis everywhere, a profound effusion, but just look at the amount of swelling. Gosh, this is a really, really bad, really painful chronic joint, and there's very little one can possibly do to make this joint a lot better. So we can We can get rid of the infection. The lameness persisted, so what can we do with this knee? Well, we can measure it up and we can perform a total knee replacement. Now, total knee replacement involves effectively removing both the femoral tibial joint and the femoral patella joint. So effectively, you're giving it two new joints in once. You're reducing the discomfort from patellofemoral contact and eliminating the discomfort from femoral tibial discomfort. So we have this press fit component in the distal femur, and we have a cemented high molecular weight polyethylene component that sits in the tibia here and can be cemented or in some techniques pressed into position down here. And this is a really, really, really good outcome surgery. It's very, very predictable. Dogs are often remarkably comfortable quite quickly, although you tend to get a steady improvement over the first 2 to 3 months from this. But conventional implants sometimes aren't enough. So this is another case we saw quite recently, a Hungarian visitor. It was 8 months old and it had a severe left hind lameness. We could see in the radiographs it had this distal femoral fracture. And we can see on the femoral condyle, we have a displaced condyle caudally. The challenge we had with this is it had been 8 weeks since the injury. So when we did the CT scan, things looked even worse. We actually had a comminuted femoral condylar fracture, and in 8 weeks, particularly in a young dog, you're going to have the situation where these fragments are going to have remodeled. So even if you did get them to heal back into position, you're really, really going to struggle with normal articular function because they're going to be remodeled, resolved. So our conventional knee replacement implants won't work either because we're looking for that press fit stability. So instead, we can take the CT scan and we can go back to biometrics and say, look, we need a custom prosthesis. So instead, the prosthesis was adapted to have this cementable femoral stem, a bit like a hip replacement, but we're using it for a knee replacement. So we design this custom prosthesis, and we can cement it in position. But what we also did is we designed this extra little abutment at the back to take the place of the gap in the condyle as well. So in surgery, these various bits and pieces allow us to do precise cuts. So this allows us to do a precise cut in the tibia. This is a trial implant to see if the cuts we've made in the femur are appropriate. And on the picture on the right-hand side, if you look a bit closely, very, very closely, you can see just hiding in the back there, we have the extra abutment to take the place of the femoral condyle. So this is what the post-operative radiographs look like. We've gone from having really quite an unhappy looking knee to a nice, well-placed femoral prosthesis. And if I show you a video of this patient, we can see how well this patient does. So it's the left hind this dog's affected by. And I think you can see 12 weeks after the surgery, this patient is walking really, really well considering how profoundly lame the patient was prior to surgery. So the important thing with this and the take home from this is even if you don't think conventional surgery will work, speak to your orthopaedic surgeon and ask, can we do something? Can we make something customised for this particular case of this particular patient? Sometimes, and we get very excited about surgery, but sometimes if we're very careful, we don't actually need to take a patient to theatre. Here's a case of a 10-week-old Doberman puppy, presents with bilateral hind limb lameness, and it's been referred in with suspected cruciate ligament disease. Now, we have to be very careful when we look at puppies with cruciate ligaments, because, of course, puppies grow very, very rapidly, but the connective tissues of the joints don't grow quite as quickly as the bones. So what you'll often have in these young puppies are slightly loose knees, slightly loose carpi, loose tarsi. And if you take a puppy and you put pressure in the cranial draw technique, you'll get what's called puppy draw. And the difference between young dogs with ruptured cruciates, and we do see young dogs with ruptured cruciates at 5-6 months of age, but the difference is when you do the cranial draw in a puppy, then you would get a very, very distinct end point when you do the cranial draw in a puppy, whereas if it was a true rupture, you don't get that distinct twang of an end point. So let's look at the radiograph. And we can see in this radiograph, yes, clearly a young puppy, but my word, there is quite a profound effusion there, isn't there? The whole joint is, the whole femoral fat pad, patellar fat pad, is effaced completely. The joint is completely full of what we assume to be synovial fluid. But if something's unusual, just check. Put a needle into the joint and just take out some fluid. So we did it with this case, and we showed that we have got pure blood inside this stifle. So we've got the puppy drawer exacerbated by effusion that's present, but we've got pure blood inside this joint. So you're thinking, aha, it's a Doberman. Maybe I think I know what's going on. But we looked at the blood test. The prothrombin time was normal. Activated partial thromboplastin time was prolonged. So it's got a coagulopathy. But von Willebrand factor was completely normal. Oh, it's a Doberman. Surely that's what it's got. But looking at other types of coagulants, we found it factor 9 deficiency, hemophilia B. So again, it can be unusual. This was treated appropriately, and the puppy made a very quick return to being sound. Now, in growing animals, we have to bear in mind that our dogs and cats grow incredibly quickly. And you can have gross disturbances that last a lifetime, but you can also have transient gross disturbances. And these transient growth disturbances can have fairly profound effects in the long term. We can have congenital causes, that is, that they're born with the problem, but they can be acquired, or you can have both. You can have congenital problems that then subsequently are exacerbated by acquired problems. So we might need to intervene in these cases when the patient's still growing to prevent a more profound deformity, but these can be incredibly challenging cases. There is no rule book about how to deal with these. Sometimes you have to be very adaptive. So here's a case where I had to do a two-stage intervention. A four-month Irish setter, a very bouncy, very, very happy dog, very bright dog, presented with unilateral carpal valgus with antibrachial procurvatum. And the radiograph showed that we had an abnormal distal radial physis, but it didn't tell us what the problem was, and the growth plate looked open, so we couldn't quite see what the issue was. But this dog was getting worse very, very rapidly, and when you flexed the carpus, it was painful. So sent in for a CT scan, and this is what we saw on the CT scan. So here we have this part of the epiphysis which has actually got left behind. As the epiphysis is trying to grow forward, as the growth plate is pushing forward, it's almost like a little locking mechanism that's in place. And as a result, what's happening here is this part is anchoring in position, whereas the outer part is in effect, so the medial part is actually continuing to grow and forcing this valgus type deformity. So what I did with this patient was actually to go in and with a spinal bar just remove this little chain, this little lock part here, and that allowed the dog some type of growth where we could actually correct this to a degree. And this worked for a couple of months before the growth plate fused prematurely, but by that stage we'd managed to maintain the length of the antibrachium. And then maintaining the length of the antibrachium, it meant that we could come back, do a corrective osteotomy, and the dog carries a fair to good prognosis in the long term. So with antibrachial deformities, again, it's something we see very, very commonly, increasingly so with the popularity of smaller chondrodystrophic breeds and brachycephalic breeds. So short ulna syndrome is when we have premature closure of the distal ulna growth plate. And as a consequence, our radius keeps growing. And it causes all sorts of problems. And the first, and I think probably most underrated aspect of this, is we get elbow dysplasia. We get narrowing of the humeral radial joint because the radius is still growing. So it's pushing up into the base of the humeral trochlea. And we get incongruity in our ulnar notch, whereby we have the humerus, the trochlea of the humerus, forced up into the anconeal process. And the gap between our medial part of the coronoid process and the humeral condyle gets increased. And this is very important because this is important in the long-term health of these dogs, that dysplastic elbows can cause osteoarthritis and make them very uncomfortable. We also see our carpal valgus. We have rotation of the radius. So rotation is when the whole bone rotates. Torsion is when the distal aspect of the bone twists relative to the proximal part. So we see these two problems. The whole radius rotates, and the whole that you get torsion as well. Procurvatum is when we get increased bend, going caudally, and we also get our classical valgus that we see with the feet twisted out. Very, very common in chondrodystrophic breeds. And dealing with these as early as possible can help restore normal weight bearing across the elbow joint. So while you've got a dysplastic elbow, perhaps with an early intervention, you can prevent it getting worse and hopefully give the dogs a better prognosis in the long term. So, when you're dealing with these dogs, if we can do a correction in a single stage, it's much better. And you've probably all seen lots and lots of very, very complicated external fixators and ring fixators for people that are doing these dynamic corrections. You make a slight correction, and then four times a day, you slightly change the length of the bone or the distance of the bone. And it's wonderful in theory, but actually you have a number of problems with this because the clients don't often like doing it. They find it challenging or they don't do it. The dogs don't like having the frame because actually, although it looks good on a person's leg or a human forearm, in our short toy breed dogs, trying to fit a bulky ring fixator and have the poor dog get any sort of sleep or comfort lying down can be very, very challenging. So if we can do a single stage correction with internal fixation, then the client doesn't have to worry about things. The dog has everything inside. You don't need a second procedure to remove pins. You don't have to worry about pins breaking, infected pin tracks. So we prefer to do everything in a single stage with internal fixation. So here is a typical problem. This is a dog I did a few years ago called Molly, and I don't think they would have any difficulty making a diagnosis of short ulnar syndrome in this patient. But let's look at the problems that we've got. We have abduction of the elbow, so you're putting abnormal forces through this elbow. We've got our carpal valgus, and we've got our paw twisted out very, very laterally. And these poor dogs, when they walk along, are walking along with both the carpus and the elbow in the wrong place. So when we look at the forces that come down through this patient, here's the weight of Molly coming into her elbow, and to counter that weight, you need an equal and opposite force coming up from the floor, which is somewhere to the lateral side of her digits. But we don't have that, because here's when the force is coming up through her carpus. So we have, effectively, the force coming up through the carpus, being twisted to come up through the antebrachium, being twisted again through the joint. This isn't good for the joint, it's not good for the way the patient walks, and we have to do something about this. So, this is how we used to approach this conventionally. You would take a dog with a bent radius. And what you would have to do is you would have to take perfectly positioned x-rays in two views. So you would take a view coming from the cranial to caudal position and get the degree of bend in that cranial caudal position. You then convert to a medial lateral x-ray and take that together. So that gives you the bend of the radius in two different planes, the frontal plane and the sagittal plane. So then we need to make some measurements. We look at the degree of bend and where it happens in the frontal plane, and we plot that in the y-axis of a graph. We do the same thing on the other view, and we measure the angle and we plot it on the x-axis of the graph. Still with me? Bear with me, it's worth it. So then what we do is we create a vector based on those two angles. And that gives us the degree of an angle of a wedge we have to cut out of the bone, and then the angle of that vector from the x-axis, called theta, is the angle at which we approach the bone. So, problems with this. It's difficult to position small dogs to get this taken accurately. It's difficult to account for rotation in the joint and torsion in the radius. It's complicated if the bone bends in two directions. So if we have the biapical deformity, we have a bend one way proximally and the other way distally to counter it, and we end up assessing dysplasia subjectively. Ultimately, this is stressful, but we can make it much, much easier for ourselves. We can take a CT scan, and the CT scan can be put onto CAD CAM software on our computer. And that allows us to look a bit more carefully in three dimensions, because we can then move this round in three dimensions and decide exactly what the correct position is proximally and distally. And we can see what we need to do with this. So in this particular patient, the case we're going to look at in some detail, we can see we've got quite a profound shift of the long axis. So this whole dog's foot is pushed out medially. So we've got this medial shift, so you can see why dogs would in effect abduct their elbow if they're trying to bring the paw back into the midline. They end up having to twist their elbow out of position. We have got fairly profound elbow dysplasia. It's quite difficult to assess this in an x-ray, but we can look in detail on the CT scan. If we look at it from the frontal plane, from lateral to medial, again we can see we've got procurvatum here, and we've actually got rotation of the radius relative to the humerus. We've got twisting out, and so as a result to adapt, this poor dog has fairly profound elbow dysplasia. Was this supposed to be the weight-bearing surface of the radial head? Has it developed a new weight-bearing surface of the radial head? So a fairly profound elbow dysplasia that we can see here. So let's look from the medial to lateral side. We can take our computer software and we can make hypothetical cuts. So when we look at this, if we want to do a single stage, single cut, here we've made the cut, we've derotated it, and we've corrected the procurvatum. It looks really quite nice. We have this straight line down through the ulna, and that's looking absolutely wonderful, isn't it? But we turn it around 90 degrees. And unfortunately, if you look at the image on the left, you'll see what we have to do to get alignment in that sagittal plane. And unfortunately, with the best one in the world, you're not going to get these bone ends to stick together because they're not even touching. So what we can try and do is we can try and give them the minimal overlap possible, which is 50%. So we shift them together to get a minimum overlap. The problem is, we've still got an 18 millimeter lateral shift, and that's a bit too much. We don't want it to shift that much. So, what can we do? Well, let's look in a bit more detail. Can we maybe make this a biapical cut? Yes, we can. So we can take the original image on the left, and we can see how shifted things were. We can make two cuts, one proximally, one distally, using the same bones, and we can get everything very nicely into alignment. It looks nice in both planes. And the problem is, as you can see quite clearly, that we've taken what is quite a long radius, and because we've had to take two fairly massive wedges out of this bone, we've got quite a short radius. And as a result, we're going to have a relatively profound shortening of our antebrachium, and we don't want to make this dog's gait any more abnormal. So we can do partial wedges. Looks much better. How accurate can we be with partial wedges? So let's look in detail what we're trying to do. And you're talking about a bone that is perhaps only 7 or 8 millimeters in width. And you're trying to take very, very precise cuts, precise wedges, precise angles, coming in at the right angle of the bone, meeting perfectly halfway or less across the bone. These are incredibly difficult cuts to make. So how enough can we possibly do this? We can look in great detail at planning this surgery. Is there such a way that we could perhaps plan the surgery specific for this dog? So what we do, and these images are courtesy of Bill Oxley in Vet3D, is we can look and see what position the bits of fragments of bone are going to end up in, and then look at where we started and how much we have to twist them. So we plan exactly where we want pins to go, exactly where we want implants to go, and then what we do is we design specific, patient-specific jigs. So these are jigs that will only fit on this patient's bone. So we design them to have in each different bit of bone, we design them to have two pinholes. So we go in during surgery, we do our surgical approach to the bone, we place this jig onto the bone, it will only sit in one place in the precise position, and we drill in each of these pins. We then have planes for us to use our oscillating saw to make perfect cuts in the bone that we know are going to be absolutely precise as we planned. The great thing is that once we've finished with the planing jig, we can then take that off and we can use a reduction pit jig. So we use the same pins, the same pinholes that we placed before, and we know by sliding this reduction jig into position, it draws all our bone fragments back into place, which gives us a double bonus because reducing these is also challenging. Remember, this radius is possibly only 7 or 8 centimeters long. So it's a reduction for us as well. It's accurate and it makes life much, much easier. So we have this plan. This is what it looks like. This would be a jig and a model for a single stage cut. So here is the patient in question. And here is the post-operative jig that we've printed as well. And the reason why we print this is because I can then take my plate out of my toolbox the day before, and I can contour my plate to fit not just this bone, but to make sure it fits beside the jig as well. So this patient was taken to theatre, and because of the small size of the patient and the relatively small size of implants, both the ulna and the radius were plated, and you can see you get very, very good reduction that's done there. So very, very happy with that as an outcome. Let's take a different tact. Let's look at pugs. And I feel awfully sorry for pugs, because pugs are very lovely dogs, and everyone wants to own a pug and everyone thinks they look lovely, but they have lots and lots and lots of problems. And with their increasing popularity, we're seeing more and more of these dogs. So here's a case, a 5-month-old pug, and it presented with progressive hind limb ataxia and paresis. And actually, by the time we saw the patient, it was non-ambulatory. She couldn't stand up, couldn't move around, not painful, but the neurological exam showed that her forelimbs were unaffected. She had upper motor neurosignes to her hind limb, so the neurolocalization is T3 to L3. The other problem we have with these dogs, generally because of brachycephalic airway disease, is respiratory compromise. But often because of spinal problems, they've got reduced thoracic volume as well. And indeed, this is the radiograph of this poor patient. So we can see quite clearly that the first problem that jumps out is a fairly marked kyphosis, quite profound. And the second thing that is, as a consequence, the lung volume, well, the poor patient doesn't really have much space to expand at all. So we've got this kyphosis with reduced lung volume. We look from dorsally, yes, we've got some scoliosis, but not too dramatic. So a CT scan, and a CT scan shows us in some detail just quite how narrowed this poor spinal cord is. How these poor patients walk, I don't know, but this poor dog had obviously coped for 5 months and simply couldn't walk anymore. So my preferred approach for these dogs is we do a thoracotomy, an intercostal thoracotomy. You move the lungs out of the way. You take the aorta and the sympathetic chain off of the spinal cord. It allows you to drill a wedge or drill part of the wedge vertebrae out of position, which then allows you to open up the spinal cord a little bit. That increases the lung volume a little bit, reduces the pressure in the spine, but also stabilizes the spine too. And we can place, this is a string of pearls plate with 3 screws either side, allows you to give really, really good stability for these cases. And we think part of the problem is that it is a dynamic issue too, so the dog trying to walk on that relatively weak part of the spine creates hypertrophy of the soft tissues, which then goes on to compress the spinal cord as well. So here we have it much, much straighter than the pre-op, and you can see with the pre-op just above that. But the slight problem we have with this is that we have to manage them as a post-op thoracotomy. So you can see there's a chest drain in position, and we can see that we have our intercostal thoracotomy to deal with as well that's there. So they can be quite challenging. But with this poor patient, she was actually up and about in 2 weeks without any problems at all. So it sounds very dramatic surgery, but they have a good prognosis, which is why I'm still happy to do things. You can approach this in a different way. So again, a pug, a little bit older, with the same presentation, paraparesis, pelvic limb ataxia of 8 weeks duration, and a T8 wedge vertebrae. If we come from the dorsal approach, it's certainly easier. You're not doing the transthoracic approach, you've got easier post-operative management. The second benefit is if you place pedicles bilaterally in the spine, you have a much stronger repair than just placing a single SOP. So if the dog has weak bones or lots of butterfly vertebrae, which aren't very strong, then you can put in pedicle screws or span bigger areas. The challenge is that really you're placing quite big screws and quite small pedicles. And sometimes you can be looking at placing 2mm screws in a 2.1mm pedicle. And you've got to be pretty accurate. And that's a pretty difficult thing to do, pretty difficult thing to achieve with consistency, because your consequences of getting it wrong is you can violate the spinal canal, which can have catastrophic consequences. So we have to be very, very careful about how we approach this. So again, using our CAD-CAM approach, we can actually individually take the strongest corridors of bone in any shape of vertebrae and say, right, this is where I want my screw to go. This is how I'm going to place it. We can then, again, specific to the patient, design the jigs that we want to give us that pattern. So we can go in surgically, we can dissect, we can place our jigs, and with confidence, we can then drill the hole both to the precise depth and the precise position that we calculated from our bone models. So we know we're not going to violate the canal. If we're working in the neck, we know we're not going to violate the vertebral arteries, which reduces the morbidity and the risks massively. So here are intraoperative pictures of the dissection and the screws placed. We then encase them in PMMA cement, which gives us a very, very rigid fixation, and we get good post-operative outcomes with these cases. So, moving on to the elbow. And this is more thinking of lameness as a multifactorial thing. And I did 6 years in first opinion practice. I know the challenges that everyone has when the patient comes into the room and you've got 10 minutes, maybe 8 minutes, maybe less, to take a history of this intermittent or chronic lameness, to do the clinical exam, to come up with the diagnosis, to explain the diagnosis, to get the treatment plan over to the client. That's extremely difficult and it can be very, very hard. And just to look at a couple of cases where what the clinical presentation looks like is actually not the diagnosis. And it's a common thing, it is common leads you astray type issues. So we often see dogs with elbow pain and we go, it's elbow problems, that must be what we should treat. So when you look at the elbow, if you extend the shoulder, what happens to the elbow? You tend to end up extending the elbow. In fact, it's very, very difficult to extend the shoulder without extending the elbow, because if you try and extend the shoulder when you're flexing the elbow, you'll often grip the elbow very, very tight. So if the dog has any soft tissue discomfort around the elbow, you're going to be grabbing this elbow quite tightly. Is the dog reacting to that? So be very, very careful when you do shoulder extension that you're absolutely certain the dog reacts to that. And then when we look at the elbow, if you extend the elbow, what's happening? If you extend the elbow, you're stretching the biceps. The biceps originates from the supraglenoid tubercle of the scapula, extends through the intertubercular groove, comes down through the biceps muscle, and inserts on the radius and the ulna. So if you're extending the elbow, you're stretching the whole muscle tendon complex of this entire muscle. If this dog perhaps has a sore biceps tendon of origin, might you be stimulating that by your elbow extension? We also have the triceps as well. If you flex the elbow, the long head of the tricep spans both the shoulder and the elbow. Is it if the dog has tricipital pain or shoulder pain, you might actually get a reaction from that as well. So when we manipulate our elbow, we're putting pressure on our periarticular structures. We're putting pressure on the distal limb because we've got to hold the antebrachium or the carpus further down. So when you get a reaction, when you get pain in the elbow, don't stop your clinical examination. Bank the knowledge. Explain it as either being elbow or shoulder pain. I tend not to differentiate between the two at the moment. I say the dog has potentially elbow or shoulder and shoulder disease. And you can get lots and lots of false positives as well based on how you carry out your clinical examination. So be careful. So here's a case of why you shouldn't stop at the elbow. 7-year-old Springer Spaniel. Owner reports several weeks of a right fore lameness. watch the dog trot up. It's got a left-hand lameness too. We get a typical diagonal lameness. Because of the dogs, the way they walk and trot, you often find that once they place the right four, the next paw to move is the left hind. And that can be speeded up, so it can look like they've got a left-hand lameness. It's just a diagonal lameness from the right four. So, clinical examination of this dog. It's got discomfort on its right elbow. It had a lateral condylar fracture previously. It's had surgery, everything was fine, but often dogs that have lateral condylar fractures, they get osteoarthritis. The assumption with this dog was, as the implants looked okay, we assumed it had an acute and chronic flare of osteoarthritis, and that would be easy. But don't stop your clinical exam. It didn't have a good response to non-steroidal. And when you looked at it closely, in its left hind, it actually had a sore digit. We did a CT scan of this hind. And if you look closely, you can see just above the palmar sesamoid, there's a small fragment sitting there. So when we look in the transverse section, we can see just underneath the metatarsus, there's swelling of the soft tissue. That's consistent with where we found the discomfort. So you can see that swelling in that area. We're very fortunate we can use the soft tissue reconstruction and we can use contrast to highlight increased blood flow, i.e. areas of inflammation. And we can start to see a bit more clearly that we've got this area of the tendon sheath that's expanded relative to the other tendon sheaths. When we look at the sagittal reconstruction, we can actually see with some detail that we've got all this abnormal swelling all the way up the tendon sheath on the plantar aspect of the foot. A needle was stuck into the tendon sheath and it showed that we had a cephalexin responsive streptococcus. A course of antibiotics was done. Whatever happened to the foreign body, we don't know. Some foreign bodies will resolve with the infection resolving. Some continue migrating. Touch wood, after a year, we haven't had any problems with this patient. Another case of not stopping at the elbow. A 5-month Labrador retriever, 2-month history of left fore lameness. It's got pain in extension of the left fore, and 9 times out of 10 you'd be completely right to say, well, we're a bit worried about elbow disease. Has this dog got elbow dysplasia? We take some radiographs. Shoulder is normal. The elbow has got changes consistent with elbow dysplasia. Fine, the referee vet did absolutely everything right, sent it in for advanced imaging and surgery. So, little quick revision, short bit of information. This is a normal elbow. Okay, when we're looking at a normal elbow, one of the early signs we're looking for in elbow dysplasia is sclerosis of the ulnar notch. And the way we're looking in a normal elbow is we're looking to see the lateral part of the coronoid process. So the lateral part of the coronoid process is an increased bone density in a line just sitting caudal to the medial part of the coronoid process and proximal to the medial part of the coronoid process. So the medial part of the coronoid process is coming up here, and then this is out to a lateral part of the coronoid process here. So this is a normal elbow. Let's look in a little bit more detail at an elbow with ulnar notch sclerosis. So we're looking at the distance of the gap from the caudal cortex of the ulna to the radial incision. So this area here, we're looking for trabecular bone pattern. And in that cranial aspect, we've lost a trabecular bone pattern, and instead we've got sclerotic bone. The rest of it is normal, so this is ulnar notch sclerosis. And to be honest, any loss of trabecular bone pattern is important, but certainly 30% or more is certainly considered pathognomic for medial coronoid process disease. So that's ulnar notch sclerosis. And again, if you'd stopped there, you would have made the correct diagnosis of elbow dysplasia. But if you kept looking at this dog further down, you would see there's something not quite right with its carpus as well. And we look closely, and there's two abnormalities here. The first I'll highlight for you, and then shift out the way. We have one change, a retained cartilage core in the ulna. And secondly, when we look above the growth plate in the metaphysis of the radius, we have this dark irregular line. So this dog has retained cartilage core and metaphyseal osteopathy. And in fact, we managed the dog conservatively and the lameness resolved. So we didn't need to do anything further with the elbow dysplasia at this point in time. Every so often, a diagnosis doesn't fit. 5-year-old Labrador Retriever, acute onset left foot lameness. It had had intermittent mild lameness on the same leg previously, and radiographs were taken at referring vets, and they showed unrelated ankle nail process, and it was referred for surgery. But this rings slight alarm bells, because it's 5 years old. We normally only see our unrelated ankle nail process causing problems in juvenile dogs. And again, we typically don't see acute onset lameness. It tends to be a bit more insidious onset or intermittent. So these are the radiographs. So this area I highlight is assumed to be the unrelated ankle nail process. But let's look a little bit more closely at the anatomy. This is what an unrelated ankle nail process looks like. That's what it should be. So when we go back and look at our original radiograph, when we outline the normal outline of the ulna, this is what we've got. So we look more closely, and this dog has fairly profound periarticular osteophytosis. So what is likely to have happened here is we've actually had a massive dorsal osteophyte in the ankle nail process that's simply fractured. And it's actually not an uncommon presentation. We can see fractures of osteophytes on the radial head, on the medial part of the coronoid process, or in the dorsal ankle nail process. And this dog, I wouldn't say its lameness resolved, but it got back to where it was before on 6 weeks of conservative management. So again, if the history doesn't fit, think a bit more carefully. What are we doing? What's going on? So a quick reminder on radiography. This was a patient that was laying on its hind limb after a fall. So we look carefully and we can see perhaps a little chip out of the femoral head, not an uncommon injury, but the hip congruity looks okay, it doesn't look dysplastic. Whenever you see our owners describe a hip pain, always, always, always take the lateral. Because when we took the lateral in this dog, this is what we saw. And in fact, this dog had a luxated hip. But by doing the extended ventridorsal, we'd simply moved the femoral head into a perfect position overlying the acetabulum. But it was luxated. So we have a luxated hip, but you just can't see it. So always take the orthogonal in these cases. And cats, we always dismiss lameness in cats. Cats are very good at just coping with it, just getting on with it. But we can do lots and lots for cats, and lameness in cats should never be ignored. So here we have a presentation, a 2-year-old male neutered British Shorthair, bilateral hind limb lameness, but definitely worse than the right. Fairly insidious onset. It had been put on meloxicam, and it got a little bit better. Pain in both hips, no neurological abnormalities, and these are the radiographs. So we can see here we've got something fairly obvious and profound going on with the proximal femur. We can see the capital physis, the femoral head doesn't look healthy, and it's displaced. Have we got changes on the left side? Perhaps, fairly subtle. Now, when looking for slip femoral capital physis, we always do the frog leg because we can see quite clearly whether things are normal or not. And on the right side, we've got this widened capital physial gap, and we've got instability that was quite palpable, but the suspicion of something going on in the left there as well. Our options are really fairly limited traditionally, and we used to do a femoral head and neck excision, but now we have this wonderful option of doing hip replacements in cats. And this patient had hip replacement, fairly small stems that go in, but it's well placed, and the cat did profoundly well. And what we often see when dogs have bilateral hip pathology is they're more comfortable on the side you operate and the side you put hip replacement in the day after surgery. They're so comfortable so quickly. So the hip replacement was done in this cat, and it immediately became very, very lame on the contralateral side. So at follow-up radiographs, we take the patient back in, and we can see quite clearly that the pathology has progressed markedly in the left-hand side. So quite clear to see, this patient needs a contralateral hip replacement, so it ended up as a cat having a bilateral hip replacement and did exceptionally, exceptionally well. Hind limb lameness in a greyhound. Every so often, you get something that you're left thinking, gosh, I haven't seen one of these before. Very, very unusual, and throws you. So a 9-year-old male greyhound was presented, an acute onset and marked right hind limb lameness. This poor dog was a lot of discomfort, carrying the leg. Minimal response to non-steroidals over the weekend and methadone. He was chewing at the right hind and really in some distress. So the clinical examination, no bone, no joint pain, no muscle pain, no nerve deficits, no pain in spinal palpation. Femoral palsy is good. But there's something pretty profound with this dog because it's in an awful, awful lot of pain. So we do an MRI scan, suspecting perhaps it might have some sort of acute disc extrusion or pressure or fibrocartilage embolism. Nothing, completely normal. So took a CT scan of the affected limb. And the first thing that jumps out is we get hypoattenuating muscle, reduced density on a CT scan. We then look in different views and we can see these patches within the quadriceps muscle. So there's something going on in the muscles of the quadriceps, which is odd because it didn't have any direct muscle pain on direct pressure. So we can do contrast. The patient has intravenous contrast imaging. And we look at the femoral arteries. So the femoral arteries are coming down through the femoral triangle out into the proximal thigh. But we can see on the left-hand side, our femoral artery comes down as it should do into the hind limb. But when we cross that over to where it should be on the right side, it's not there. The femoral arteries is not there at all. So ischemic myopathy. The dog has a blood clot that's formed in the femoral artery. And this is something that we do see most commonly in sighthounds. It's usually associated with the protein-losing nephropathy, and that's exactly what this patient had after we did further tests. So the first thing we have to do is prevent further clots. We use clopidogrel and aspirin, but unfortunately it has a guarded prognosis and they can form secondary clots. But we can see very nicely in this sagittal reconstruction, this is where we expect the femoral artery to be, and we get a very slight doming of the blood vessel in the contrast, which is what we see in people that have the same condition. We can do lots and lots in terms of managing fractures, and the technology is constantly advancing for us to come up with different techniques to treat what can be very, very difficult fractures in patients. So 9-year-old domestic short hair is presented with, I think, what can only be described as a pretty nasty humeral fracture. It's comminuted, yes, but we've got significant soft tissue trauma here as well. And this is an issue, because with cats, if you can, you want to try and plate the caudomedial aspect for a couple of reasons. The first reason is the anatomy in cats is slightly different. So we have this supracondylar foramen here, where the brachial artery and median nerve pass through. And if you can visualize that, it makes life a lot easier. The second thing is that the tension side in the distal humerus is the caudomedial aspect as well. It changes proximally. But if you can get a medial plate on, it's usually preferable. Sometimes you have to place bilateral plates. But with significant trauma to a soft tissue, we want to minimize the dissection because we run the risk of, if not ischemic necrosis, increasing the risk of infections or non-unions. So our open reduction is going to be challenging. If we're going to do a minimally invasive surgery, and a minimally invasive surgery is where we don't open the whole surgical site or limited open it, and we make two small holes either side and tunnel the plate down, reconstructing this accurately is going to be incredibly difficult. Even with fluoroscopy, we've got some challenges ahead of us. So we can use our CT scans again to look at this. So we first have to start off by, what's a normal bone? So we can CT the contralateral humerus and flip it round in a mirror image to give us what we think the humerus should look like. We can then take our principal fragments from the fracture and we can put them into that bone, into where it should be, so we know exactly where those fragments should be in space. We can then design, again, patient and bone-specific jigs for those fragments, and then design a system whereby we can use the pins that held these initial jigs in place. We can use a bigger jig to hold the bone fragments into position to allow us to do a minimally invasive surgery. So these are the jigs. These are the bone-specific jigs in position. We can also take our printed contralateral humerus in its mirror image, and we can bend the plate so we know if we get the bone fragments in the right place and put this plate, where we plan to put the plate, everything's going to be in the correct rotational and angular alignment. So during surgery, a small proximal approach to place the jig and the pins, a small distal approach to place the jig and the pins. We place then a reducing jig across between the two. We can tunnel in our plate, and this is a post-operative reconstructed CT scan where you can see we've got some really quite nice alignment of the fragments. But most importantly, the joints are in the right place doing the right thing. 6 weeks after surgery, I think it was 8 weeks after surgery, we've got absolutely wonderful healing because the fracture site wasn't disturbed and the patient is doing really rather well. So, just to sum up, take home messages from my talk, orthopedics is quite comfortably the most exciting specialism one can possibly do. Common things are common, but weird things do happen, and the only way to spot that is to be thorough. Even if you don't get to the precise final diagnosis, you can phone up an orthopedic surgeon and have a chat with them and say, look, it's not right, what do you think? And they can give you some hints and tips, or of course you can refer the case. The lameness can be multifactorial, so be thorough. Just because you find one thing, then it doesn't mean to say that there aren't other things going on. There's no such thing as an untreatable lameness. Speak to your orthopaedic specialist, and they might be able to give you some advice or take it on and come up with a solution that isn't described. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll try and answer some questions. So, first question, if I can just bring that up. When doing a knee replacement, do you place... I can't quite read that. Bear with me, everybody. When doing a knee replacement, do you place it similar to a TPLO so the cruciates are redundant? Absolutely. So when we do a knee replacement, what effectively you're doing is removing the entire femoral-tibial joint. You effectively remove all the cartilage from the femoral patella joint right round through the condyles to the caudal part of the joint. So menisci, cruciate ligaments, cartilage and everything come out of the joint, and then the proximal tibia is completely osteotomized, so the entire stability of the stifle is dependent on the interaction between the proximal and the distal components. So the type of system, the stability is maintained by the collateral ligaments, and it's maintained by the intrinsic stability of what's called a semi-constrained system, so the two implants have intrinsic stability. As I say, it's a really, really, really nice surgery, because the patients, although they don't get better just quite as quickly as they do with hip replacement, you can take patients that really would be looking at amputation, if that's not feasible, arthrodesis, and stifle arthrodesis, it is done, it's not that difficult to do, but the outcome is very variable, the complications are pretty high, whereas knee replacement, it is a bit more expensive, but you have a very, very good outcome from that. So one other question in terms of the 3D guides, are 3D guides expensive to produce? 3D guides, they're not inexpensive, but the big benefit that you achieve with them is that your surgical time is massively reduced and your accuracy is improved as well. So overall, they're probably cost neutral in the long-term basis. And again, you know you're doing something very, very accurately. Okay, thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kinley for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.